Coming up today, we continue our look at sexual violence on college campuses with the question, what happens when the perpetrator is a professor?
A lot of people were silenced into not talking about their bad experiences with the phrase, what happens in the field stays in the field.
We'll talk with University of Illinois anthropologist Kate Clancy about her research on sexual harassment in the sciences. Later, we'll have a look at today's weather and a warning about what's possibly ahead this evening with atmospheric scientist Jeff Frame. But first,
I think I'm living proof that somebody can change. I didn't start out as a racist. I became a racist for 7 years. So I wasn't born that way. So I did change from being a non-racist to a racist back to a non-racist.
That's former white supremacist Christian Picciolini. He's the founder of the Chicago-based Life After Hate. We talked to him about how his federal funding may now be in jeopardy. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Christian Picciolini wasn't born into a Klan family, and his upbringing in Blue Island, just outside Chicago, doesn't seem like one that would make him turn to white supremacist groups. But as a troubled teen and then into his young adulthood, he was an active skinhead. After he found his way out, he started speaking about his experience, and he helped start a group. Life After Hate helps people leave white supremacist organizations. A recent study by George Washington University found that American white nationalist movements have seen their social media followers grow by more than 600% in the past 5 years. In fact, the study found that neo-Nazi and white nationalist movements outperform ISIS in nearly every social metric, from follower accounts to tweets per day. The Trump administration is considering shifting funding away from preventing white nationalist groups to putting more money into fighting Islamist terrorist groups. That could jeopardize the funding of groups like Christians, who joins me now from Chicago. Hi, Christian. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla. It's great to speak with you again.
Christian, you helped start Life After Hate because it was so difficult for you to leave your former life in being a skinhead. But before we get to that, I feel like people probably want to know, how did you first get involved in all of this?
You know, I was kind of like just any other teenager. I was searching for three very important things that most young people search for, and that is a sense of identity, sense of community, and also a sense of purpose. And at 14 years old, I was a little bit lost. I had been marginalized and bullied quite a bit because of my parents being immigrants and not really fitting in, and also being pretty shy. When a man one day walked up to me when I was standing in an alley at 14 years old smoking a joint, and he came up to me, and the man had a shaved head and boots, and the year was 1987. And he walked up to me and he grabbed a joint from my mouth and he looked me in the eyes and he said, "Don't you know that that's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile?" And I was 14 years old. I didn't quite know what a communist was or if I'd met a Jewish person at that point, and hardly knew what the word docile meant, but I was suddenly struck with this man who is twice my age and his charisma and his ability to talk to me as an adult and not tell me that smoking pot was bad for me like my parents would tell me, or that it was stupid, or what would other people think. But he seemed to give me a reason that other people were trying to control me through this. And I started to listen and very quickly became indoctrinated into the racist propaganda.
So you had about 7 years of this, right, Christian? I know you and I have talked about this a lot in the past, although not here on air on the 21st. You had moments during those 7 years, didn't you, where you kind of thought, like, this is not what I should be doing?
Yeah, because I really wasn't raised with that as a foundation of my childhood.
No, your parents were immigrants.
Yeah, they were Italian immigrants who came to the U.S. in the mid-60s, and they were often the victims of prejudice themselves. So it wasn't really something that was brought up in the home. In fact, it was quite the opposite. But because my parents were immigrants, when they came to this country, they had to work very, very hard to support the family. And they were often gone 7 days a week, sometimes 14 hours a day working. And I felt slightly abandoned by them, and also felt a little bit embarrassed by the fact that they were immigrants, because I was being made fun of in the communities that I lived. So I was looking for an alternate kind of narrative that fit this ambition that I had. And when this man, who happened to be America's first neo-Nazi skinhead, kind of walked into my life, I was very attracted to that lifestyle because it promised me that all the problems that I had would go away and that I could blame other people for those problems.
So you have sort of, you know, you were in this for years. There were a lot of bad things that happened. You got to a point, though, where you realized, I can't do this anymore. What, for you, what was that moment?
You know, it was a series of events, Nyla. It was, I always had the confusion and the questions in the back of my mind, but the power that belonging to this group kept me in. And it was a series of events that started when I was 19 years old and got married and had our first child. And when I held that child in my arms for the first time, I simply reconnected with my innocence. And that was the first catalyst for me. I had something to love finally, rather than something to hate. And then because I was still confused about the ideology and still was so hesitant to leave, even though I'd begun to lose my ideology, I didn't want to give up the identity and the community. I decided I was going to open a small record shop to sell white power music, and the music became very popular. It was 75% of my gross revenue. But I also began to sell other music like hip hop and punk rock and heavy metal. And when the customers came in to buy that music, who were of all races and religions, I started to bond with them, and I started to finally humanize with them when I began to engage in personal conversation, because I had never met the people that I hated. I'd never had a meaningful dialogue with them. And in fact, I think I hated other people because I really hated myself. I hated the situation and how I felt, and I was projecting my own pain onto other people. But when I started to dialogue for the first time with African Americans and with Jewish people and with gay people, I began to realize that we actually had more similarities than differences. And suddenly I couldn't reconcile my hate. And when I decided to pull the white power music from the shelves, of course, my store tanked. But it gave me an opportunity to really disengage from this movement and start a new life.
You made a really interesting distinction, Christian, that I want to ask you about, because you talked about ideology and identity, and that's the work that you do now with Life After Hate, helping people get out. For you, how hard was it? I wonder if you can kind of help people understand, who have never been involved with this, how hard it is, maybe even if you don't believe in it anymore, if you recognize that this is something that is completely hateful and wrong, but maybe it's still part of your identity. How hard is it to separate from that?
It's very difficult. And in fact, that's the reason why we started Life After Hate, was to create that safe place to transition out, because the identity and the community is so important. You've had to leave everything else in your life that matters to you behind. You often leave your family behind, your friends, your hobbies, all the things that you love to do. And you trade it all in for this new identity and this new sense of community and purpose. And once you've given up everything from your life that's meaningful, leaving this movement is very difficult, because starting over is very daunting. And not only are you starting over trying to build a new identity and a new community, you are still branded with the actions of your past. And for some people, it's too daunting to start over, so they end up just staying in for the camaraderie and for this identity that gives them the sense of false power, rather than just detaching and starting completely over.
Christian, you know, I was reading about white nationalism last night, and I was looking at data that shows the number of homegrown hate groups in the U.S. In 2015 jumped by 14%. We'll tweet out that data if those of you listening are interested, if you followed 21st Show. Christian, what have you seen in the past year? That's from 2015. What did you see in 2016?
Well, what I've seen is that what used to live in the shadows, what the racism that used to be unacceptable to say in open open spaces to people, now has come out of the shadows since Election Day, because it's as if a bucket of gasoline has been kicked over and lit all these smoldering fires all across the U.S. into a large wildfire. And they feel very emboldened, because so much of what we said in the movement about immigrants and about the media and about minority groups is being said now by people in power. And the people who belong to these groups or ideologies now feel very emboldened, and as if that they're part of the mainstream, and it's legitimized the ideology to a certain degree. So we're seeing a lot more hate crimes. We're seeing desecration of synagogues and cemeteries. And we're seeing the mainstreaming of the ideology, because we had this concerted effort 30 years ago that we called leaderless resistance, which is now being called the alt-right, where we said, you know, we're scaring away even racist people by waving our swastikas and getting tattoos and being skinheads. We should clean up our image and mainstream it by enrolling in university, wearing a suit and a tie, going into law enforcement, running for office, and just taking the message and making it just a little bit more palatable to the average person and focusing on their grievance. And then we recognized that we could more easily recruit those people. Now, here we are 30 years later, and in fact, what we're seeing is what's being called the alt-right, which to me, having seen the inside of how that started, is really just neo-Nazism with just, you know, slightly more massaged language and dog whistles.
How does it, I mean, how do you feel about it as someone who has been involved with this and watching this happen? How does it make you feel now?
I'm very concerned, and I've been concerned for years because I've seen this happening, and it's terrifying to a certain degree because we are actually now seeing actions against marginalized people, such as, you know, the travel ban or the possible registration of Muslims, and also the increase in hate crimes. So to me, this was something that was building for a long time, and now, even though people are more interested in being active, the average person who maybe isn't a protester or isn't a political activist is now very interested in starting to do something to combat this problem. And I just hope that with the new administration, that programs that focus on anti-Semitism and white extremism aren't eliminated from the focus, because the truth is, since 9/11, more Americans have been killed on U.S. soil by white supremacists than by any other foreign or domestic terrorist group combined. And we have a large domestic terrorism problem already within our borders, with militia groups training in paramilitary camps, often targeting minorities and law enforcement. And it's something that we definitely need to be aware of, we need to be vigilant of, and recognize it exists, but also build bridges to the communities where these people are being affected, because they're completely horrified with what's happening.
So you actually received, you're talking about funding, you all, Life After Hate, received a $400,000 grant from the Justice Department the last few days of the Obama administration. Are you worried about losing that funding now?
You know, I'm concerned, but I haven't received any official word. We applied for a grant to develop a program for online intervention, both for white extremists and for jihadists. And we were told we won the grant. And then 2 weeks later, we were told that possibly our grant proposal could be reviewed and that the money wouldn't be paid out because there might be a shift in the focus for the Countering Violent Extremism program, where before it was very community-led, now it seems like it may turn into more of a counterintelligence or militaristic program. And we've switched our focus. You know, we always plan on continuing our work. So, you know, even if the government grants do end up not coming through, we've switched our focus to the private sector and to people, because corporate responsibility programs, and I think just people in general, are more aware of the problem and willing to help. So we will continue our work regardless of what happens. But certainly I'm concerned if our government does switch its focus from a balanced approach to all different types of extremism to just one, that it may marginalize certain communities and also further embolden white extremists.
Christian, I mentioned that study that George Washington University did just a couple months ago, looking at neo-Nazi and white national movements and how much actually in social media they actually outperform ISIS, whether we're talking about tweets or follower accounts. What kind of work are you, you mentioned the work that you're doing, what kind of work are you trying to do in the digital space in this realm?
Well, part of the grant that we won and applied for but haven't been paid out yet was to develop an online intervention peer-to-peer program where we would identify people who are at risk of becoming extremists, both in white extremism and in all types of extremism, and then deploy a one-on-one strategy where we would actually reach out to those people to try and start a conversation with them. What we find is oftentimes the white nationalists online are going down a rabbit hole of misinformation and fake news and propaganda related to the far right that inflates statistics like black on white crime or is just simply publishing fake news to further their agenda. And that's something that is a growing problem. And because the internet is so unregulated, which I support to a certain degree, I believe in an open internet, but I do believe that we also need to serve a counter narrative messaging and also be aware of what exists. But it's certainly not getting that grant could certainly impact that. But we've continued with a plan B to be able to continue our work and focus on a very important issue that is online radicalization.
And apart from the online, how important is that one-on-one communication for getting people out of these groups?
Well, I think it's very important because you do have kind of the hive mentality or the groupthink mentality if we're trying to approach groups where people are afraid of being vulnerable with their colleagues. So a one-to-one approach is very important because it gives space for people to be open, to have an honest dialogue, and also to be vulnerable when they need to.
Well, and also to help people if people are trying to get out, or as you did, you know, you recognized for a long time you had to leave, and you tried to, some people, their families are involved, you know, they are, it's like leaving a gang, you know, there's a lot of violence
sure.
if you try to leave. Those are the kind of things I imagine sure. you guys are working on too.
Yeah, it's very dangerous. Not only is it hard to leave because of, you know, the idea of starting over is very daunting, but it's also very dangerous in certain circumstances because people, when they abandon their real communities to join these ideological communities, are completely surrounded by the people from these extremist movements. So doing something in a very one-to-one fashion, a very personal fashion that's confidential is paramount to trying to reach people.
That's the work that Chicago-based Life After Hate is doing. That's co-founder Christian Picciolini joining us. Christian, thanks for being with us. Thanks for sharing all of this.
Nyla, my pleasure.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. University of Illinois anthropologist Kate Clancy was once giving a campus talk about her work with Scientific American, and afterwards she met up with a friend who was taking a while to finish her dissertation. Kate teasingly asked her what it would take to finally finish and become a professor, and her friend shared something deeply personal. She had been assaulted in the field, and she had PTSD, and every time she looked at her data, she had flashbacks. That was a wake-up call for Kate. All this week, we've been talking about sexual assault on college campuses, and we're going to be talking about this for the next 15 minutes or so. Professor Clancy is in studio with me to discuss sexual harassment and assault at universities, her focus of research. Kate, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
I can't imagine what it would have been like for you to have that conversation with your friend. Can you take me back to that time and tell me sort of how that all came about?
Sure. I'm someone who, when I was in college, I was a rape crisis counselor. I was involved in Take Back the Night. I was, you know, involved in a number of feminist movements for my entire life. And I was a labor organizer in graduate school. So there are ways in which I've been thinking about and interfacing with issues of sexism in science for a really long time. But there was something about having a dear friend of mine, someone who I'd known for several years and cared for very deeply, share with me the details of her own personal experience in the field. And I think what that really did is it made me realize in some ways how inadequate my feminism was at the time. I'd really been thinking a lot about agency. And I was like, if we just pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, that's going to fix everything. And it was a moment that I crashed right into this issue of structural sexism, where you can do everything right. You can, you know, be a fantastic scholar. You can be doing stellar field work and still run into someone who decides that you are an object as opposed to someone with a really great mind.
When we think about this, all week we're talking about this. Yesterday we talked about this on the program in terms of issue of students and undergraduate students, what sort of the sexual assaults that have happened at fraternities, at university, here at the University of Illinois, at Northwestern University. This is something entirely different when you look at what happens when the perpetrator is a professor and you're a graduate student and this is your advisor. And this is an area I think a lot of people don't really think about, especially when you are in the sciences. What have you found? You've started blogging about this. You started hearing from a lot of people about this.
Mm-hmm. a big thing that we did, you know, that I did notice anecdotally in the beginning is what you're saying, that there was a power differential, right? Someone who maybe had some say over your work being the one who is perpetrating these assaults or these various kinds of discrimination. And then, of course, that ended up getting borne out when we did the full study with three other collaborators, excellent collaborators who have quantitative and qualitative expertise. So we were able to work on this project together, I think, in a way that, you know, far transcends what I would have been able to do by myself. So this was Robin Nelson, Julian Rutherford, and Katie Hind. The four of us together conducted a survey doing snowball sampling. So what that means is just that it's not random. You know, we aren't like the Pew Research Center with tons of money getting some fraction of the total number of scientists of the world. We used a lot of word of mouth and just trying to pass the survey along to as many people as we could. But we managed to get over 600 field scientists to participate. And we found that among women, the perpetrators were often senior to them in the hierarchy, whereas for men, perpetrators were very often peers. So not only did harassment and assault happen far more frequently to women, in our sample at least, it also looked like the nature of the harassment and the assault were different. And so these vertical abuses, things that are happening to you from people above you in the hierarchy, have much more severe consequences for your career, more severe consequences for your mental health. There's a whole literature that looks at sort of job turnover intentions as related to these vertical abuses.
And let's talk about that. Let's sort of break that down for a minute, because when you're talking about let's talk about the impact on a career. And I imagine so much of when we talk about sexual harassment or sexual violence, there are consequences to women speaking out. And when this is something that happens in a workplace, in this case, in academia, what kind of stories did you hear about from this survey also?
I think one of the tougher stories that I heard was actually from a male respondent. So we also interviewed 26 folks out of the 600. And this respondent actually spent a lot of time talking about the benefits he gained by being a bystander, a silent bystander, to repeated sexual assaults to all of the women of the field site, effectively. The director would do various things in terms of unwanted touching, unwanted kissing, trying to pressure women into sex. And, you know, it wasn't a large enough place that anyone knew, you know, everyone knew it was happening. And he knew it was happening. And in some moments, he would sometimes protect his friends or have his friends sleep on the floor in his room. But he also benefited enormously. And he was one of the sons. He was literally called a son of this director. And one of the golden boys who was able to get access to materials that the women weren't allowed to have access to was taken on special trips to see special collections that the women didn't have access to. So there was a really, you know, he was an accomplice in some very real ways. And he literally said to me towards the end of the interview, "I'm talking to you today to absolve me of my guilt."
Wow. When you think about this and you share these stories, I'm thinking of an incident last year, actually, at the University of Chicago. There was a biology professor, Jason Lieb, who resigned in the middle of an investigation into multiple allegations of sexual misconduct, including unwelcome sexual advances in terms of female graduate students. Were you surprised by how, I don't know if common is the word that you would want to use, or are you surprised by these stories?
I'm not. And I think in the beginning, there was a little part of me that was surprised that it happened among scientists. And then that, you know, then when I reflected on my own massive experiences of gender discrimination over the years, I kind of realized, you know, scientists are human. We're subject to the same acculturation, to the same experiences of racism and sexism and ableism and many other isms as every other human on the planet. And so, unfortunately, yes, these things are somewhat common in science. I wouldn't say that they're more common in science than other places, because I would just say we still have a problem with recognizing women as whole human beings. I think we have a problem with that around people of color, around people with different physical abilities, different sexualities as well. We don't recognize them as full humans. And so, you know, there are some people who don't believe they deserve full treatment. I mean, we just elected someone who joked about sexual assault leading up to the election on November 8th, and he's still our president anyway.
I want to talk about there's a legislative effort that you've been supportive of, and I want to talk about that in a minute. But first, I just want to ask you about what makes it, I imagine, you know, there's a lot of literature, there's a lot of research about sexual harassment in, say, office environments. I imagine there's even probably more research on sexual harassment in a place like a factory floor than there are in academia, and particularly in science. And as you're talking about in field sites, what particular challenges are there to ensuring that this doesn't happen? I wonder what's different about when people are off if they're on field sites or they're on trips or they're working in these small environments. What other particular challenges are there in terms of trying to make sure that this doesn't happen and create a different culture?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a huge challenge. I think that it requires a multi-level approach. So the main challenges are that a lot of field sites are very small. It's one PI or one principal investigator or, you know, scientist who's kind of in charge of the project, and some folks that work for that person. They could be locals. They could be grad students, undergrads, fellow researchers. And sometimes that's the entire field site. Other times you have a field school that's run by multiple PIs who might all have different ideas of what constitutes appropriate behavior, and 50 or 70 different students operating there. So you have very different scales. You have, you know, Title IX does technically apply in these spaces, because even though they're not campus locations, they still are affiliated with a university usually or some kind of institute of higher learning. So technically, especially the ones that are coming out of U.S. institutions, they are supposed to be treated like professional spaces. Unfortunately, there's just a long history in science of these sites not being treated like professional workplaces. And so instead, they're treated like vacations. We have a significant number in our interview sample of people telling stories of male PIs who have mistresses and at their field site, that everyone at the field site is expected to keep quiet when they go home, and that PI has a family and children back home. So there's just a real disconnect for some folks. In fact, the phrase that we heard over and over again was that a lot of people were silenced into not talking about their bad experiences with the phrase, what happens in the field stays in the field. Mm. A couple quick things that have, I think, started to make some headway. A number of professional societies, so these are, you know, groups of scientists organizing around common disciplines, you know, so the main one I'm affiliated with is the American Association of Physical Anthropologists, as well as the American Anthropological Association. A lot of them have issued zero tolerance statements. The NSF, the National Science Foundation, has also done that. That's at least a first step. When there are no consequences associated with those, it doesn't have as much teeth, but it's at least a first step. A next step is people are starting to create templates for codes of conduct for their field sites. Another is that people are starting to publicly shame those folks who are known predators, people who have, over the last 20 years, been harassing and assaulting many women, and everybody knows it. And I think that it's going to take a lot of those different things, as well as, when possible, when safe, people actually coming forward and actually prosecuting some of these behaviors.
And when you say that last point about when possible, when safe, a lot of times when we're talking about academia, that person, their success depends very much on getting a strong letter of recommendation from their advisor. This could be your entire future, your entire career that you could be jeopardizing.
Exactly. Which is why I'm a scientist who studies the ways in which environment affects reproductive function in women. And yes, I'm a social scientist, and I'm trained in those methods as well. And I have a whole research program doing those kinds as well. But I'm not a lawyer. I'm not someone who should be giving advice around these things. And yet I'm constantly asked by people. I get emails all the time from people who are experiencing discrimination, harassment, and assault. And they want to know what to do. And I never tell people, oh, the first thing you should do is report it to the Title IX office. I tell them that's one of the range of options they have. But every option carries with it potential consequences. And depending on the university, those consequences can be really severe.
You've been very supportive of a federal legislative effort that was led by California Representative Jackie Speier that would require schools to disclose when professors are found guilty of sexual assault or harassment. This goes back to the University of Chicago case last year. I know that there were reports about how this had been something that had been known in his previous position at his previous university, but that somehow hadn't translated when this particular person went to the University of Chicago. What's going on with that legislative effort?
Not a lot appears to be going on with this effort right now, though I think it did do some really amazing things in terms of building awareness. This is absolutely part of Representative Speier's general platform. She's been working on issues of sexism and harassment and assault across many axes for many years, and it's something I really greatly admire about her. And I think that this bill, while currently I don't think it's really going anywhere, she did get bipartisan support. And I think that the press conference was pretty well attended, and I think there were a lot of scientists who realized maybe we can't keep hiding from this. She used this term in the press conference called "pass the harasser," which is kind of what you're referring to, where someone gets accused or even found guilty of harassment or assault in one location, and then before that can go public, frankly, the university doesn't want to look bad, so they won't go public with it. They get a job elsewhere, and this happens a lot. And by creating some way for these folks to have to be penalized through not being able to get their federal funding, or at least for federal funding agencies to know about it, decreases the chance that the next university is going to be so excited to pick this person up.
Do you mention the current administration? You mentioned President Trump. Do you think that the legislation's progress? I mean, where do you think it'll stand now, given the fact that Republicans are in control? You said it was a bipartisan effort. So I wonder how you think the current administration is going to affect this effort.
I'm not confident, but I wouldn't pretend to be, a legislative expert by any means. But my guess is that nothing's going to really happen with it right now. If Democrats were in power, I'd be a bit more confident.
Apart from the legislation, what kind of work do you think universities, different academic institutions need to do to be better about changing the culture around this issue?
I think the big thing is to stop focusing on compliance and liability. My experiences with a lot of campuses, I've flown all over the country at this point, meeting with various administrators, field site directors, and spoken with people at the University of Illinois. And the most frustrating thing is when the campus or the administrators in charge of these issues situate themselves as people who are focused on compliance. Well, the federal law says everyone needs to get training, so we're going to trot out the most boring, dumbest online training that is going to make everyone resentful and of sexual harassment training and not take this seriously. And we're worried about liability. So, one of the most useful pieces of information I got from someone who's a former Title IX coordinator at a different university was the safest position for a university is always to do nothing, because it's rare that a victim will ever sue. They worry that there's an increased chance that the perpetrator will sue. And so it's better to just do nothing and say, well, maybe we found them guilty or maybe not, but the perpetrator can stay.
We're going to be talking more about Title IX tomorrow on the program. That's Kate Clancy. She's an associate professor in anthropology at the University of Illinois. I should mention for everyone listening to this conversation, if you need help, the National Sexual Assault Hotline number is 1-800-656-4673. Again, that's 1-800-656-4673. Kate, thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've had lots of weather news this past week, and especially tonight, we're seeing some forecasts for severe thunderstorms for basically most of the state. Some of that could also create conditions for tornadoes, even though it is February 28th. So we thought we'd bring in Jeff Frame. He's a meteorologist. He's an atmospheric scientist. He teaches in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. He's in studio with me now. Hey, Jeff, welcome back to The 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this evening. I've seen some forecasts for hail, for severe thunderstorms. What do we need to know about? And it's pretty much almost the entire state this evening.
Right. It's almost the entire state, except for the far northern fringe counties right up near the Wisconsin border. Those areas, lesser threat up there. But really, you know, almost from US 20, I-88 on south, there's a risk of severe weather tonight. So let's try to break that down. It's going to come in a couple different waves. So I think first, this afternoon, there could be some scattered storms developing around northwest Illinois. And by mid to late afternoon, and those storms do have potential for producing all modes of severe weather, tornadoes, large hail, and damaging winds. And those, I think, quickly move on out to the east. I think another band gets going over Missouri around the same time, and that sweeps across, again, most of the state this evening. And large hail, damaging wind, and tornado risk again with that. That clears into Indiana. Then probably a break again from west to east. Then the third and final round gets going along a cold front in the middle of the night, and that sweeps southeast across the state. Wind risk with that, as well as some hail, some tornado risk that's a bit more conditional with that line of storms. But what this means is it's over. A lot of this is going to be focused after dark. So that means have a way to get warnings. You're not going to be able to wait to see something coming, and these storms are going to be moving very quickly, about highway speed, 50, 60, even 70 miles an hour. So make sure to have a way to get warnings overnight tonight.
Jeff, I think people are thinking it's February 28th. You know, is this unheard of to have a tornado in February in Illinois?
Tornadoes in February in Illinois aren't unheard of. Back on February 29th, 2012, about 5 o'clock in the morning, the small town of Harrisburg in the far southern part of the state was hit with an EF4 tornado. So that, again, speaks to the importance of being able to get warnings in the middle of the night. Now, as we head later into the spring months, of course, severe weather becomes more common across the state.
And Jeff, we've just seen such strange temperatures in the past month or two. We saw the news this weekend that Chicago, for the first time in history, at least in recorded history, there was no snow on the ground for all of January and February.
Yeah, that's right. After a very snowy December up there, January and February were very warm months, and it's really hard to get snow if it hasn't been cold. And February, for example, in a lot of places across the state, I know here in Champaign-Urbana, for one, is going to finish as the warmest February on record. And when you're talking about record high temperatures like we've seen so much of the 60s and 70s in the past week, it's very hard to get a lot of snow with a pattern like that.
And it's also then, and these thunderstorms that you're talking about this evening, are these different systems that are moving in that we're going to see?
Tonight we're really looking at the same system. It's just going to spawn multiple rounds of storms. I think a weaker little impulse comes out in Missouri, triggers that evening round I talked about. And then the cold front that sweeps in behind all of this overnight tonight, that triggers that line of storms. It's going to sweep northwest to southeast, and some areas, especially east and south in the state, the storm risk could be going until well past midnight tonight.
I'm talking to Jeff Frame. He's a meteorologist. He's based here at the University of Illinois in studio with me in Urbana. We're talking about the weather, Jeff. We've gotten a lot of alerts from the National Weather Service this week about classes. You mentioned warmer spring weather, and it's classes actually for storm spotting. There's one tonight in DuPage County. There's classes next week in Lake Kendall in Cook counties. There's a class in Vermilion County next week. What the National Weather Service is a spotting training class, what is that?
Okay, so weather spotters are really important to the National Weather Service. When they issue a severe thunderstorm warning or a tornado warning, they want to know if that weather actually occurred. Is there a tornado? So they can put that in the warning and cause people to take action. Or we've actually seen hail this big. We can confirm that and put that in the warning and get people to take action. And it's important that the spotters who are out there giving them this information are trained. For example, we want to report hail, things like peas, golf balls, baseballs if it gets that big, and not things like marbles that can have different sizes, or eggs, for example.
Okay, so it really is standardizing the terminology of the size of something like hail, for example.
Right, that, and then when you get to tornadoes, a lot of folks who may have never chased or been around severe storms before go out and see any low-hanging cloud, or they'll call it a wall cloud or a funnel and something like that. And if the cloud isn't rotating, it may just be a low cloud hanging under the storm that's completely not dangerous, and we don't want those reports then going into the National Weather Service. So it's important to have that training to be able to say what I'm seeing is actually what I'm seeing.
And how much does the National Weather Service rely on spotters, who I assume are just kind of your average person who's interested in weather? How important is this, are spotters?
Quite a bit. They provide the ground truth to what's happening down on the ground. And their reports, those reports actually go into the National Severe Weather Database of tornadoes or hail or wind. And say if me or anybody else in atmospheric sciences wants to do a study about tornado reports or hail reports, for example, we're going to use that database in our research. So it's very important not only to the Weather Service and the public on the warning perspective, but also it serves as a basis for doing severe weather research.
What kind of qualifications do you need to go to one of these classes? Is there a certain age you have to be? What do you know in terms of what kind of folks normally do this?
I'm not aware of an age limit, but generally folks tend to be mid-teens and higher than that. And they're open to anybody.
Okay. Now, this obviously, storm spotting is different than storm chasing. And I wanted to ask you about, when we were talking about news of storm spotters, storm chasing, I think storm chasers, weather geeks all across the country came together on Sunday to honor Bill Paxton.
Yeah, Bill Paxton is best known to people like myself in the meteorology community as playing Bill Harding in the movie Twister from 1996. In that movie, although the science isn't accurate at times, to be nice.
You know what? Actually, Jeff, we have a clip of it. Should we play that and then you can tell us about what was accurate and what wasn't?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Here's a little bit of Twister.
Yeah, Joe, we know Dad isn't complete. I think you guys should get out of there. You copy?
The scene from Twister, something that it's kind of one of is that your favorite movie? Is it a cult movie?
It's one of my favorites. It's certainly up there. And among the storm chaser community and meteorologists, it's gained a bit of a cult following. Yes.
Right. I have to say, that's my favorite. My favorite subgenre of action movie is natural disaster. So I also love these movies, but I don't have the academic interest that you do. So you're saying the science of it, maybe not entirely there.
It's not always there, but the basis of the basis of the story is Bill and Joe. He's going to be getting divorced from his wife, Joe, and she's out doing a storm chase expedition. And they have this probe called Dorothy that is designed to be put in the path of a tornado and then hit by the tornado. That itself is based in fact. Back in the 1980s, the National Severe Storms Laboratory designed a very similar instrument called TOTO, the Totable Tornado Observatory, to be put in the path of a tornado. Now, that TOTO was never hit in reality, but there are several new generations of weather probes meant to be deployed in the path of tornadoes to gather information inside of them. However, when we're deploying these probes, we don't want to be that close.
You don't want it, don't want it to be right above you.
Ideally, you'd want the tornado to be a few miles to your west. You deploy the probe, and then you drive out of the way. But in reality, putting something down in the path of a tornado and having it hit it is a lot harder than you might think.
Oh, well, that makes sense, actually. Yeah, I wouldn't think of that. So that was Bill Paxton, who unfortunately passed away this weekend, complications from surgery. And everybody sort of came together in this huge area using weather spotter markers to honor him. Can you explain this? Because when I looked at the weather map, there was like a radar. I don't know if it was a satellite image. It sort of spelled out BP, but this must have been hundreds or maybe more people across the country that lined themselves up to create this image.
Yeah, I know it was at least 200 spotters and chasers who were involved in this. And there are several ways to do this. You can join something called Spotter Network. It's like being a storm spotter with the Weather Service. You have to take a quiz in order to do that. And there are apps, for example, like RadarScope on your phone. That's what I use. And it one option it lets you do is display the locations of storm spotters as a red dot. And now 200 people, including myself, didn't suddenly drive to Oklahoma and Kansas on Sunday afternoon. What we did is we used various software packages, either on our phone or on a computer, to bogus our GPS positions to spell out the initials.
I see. So yes. No one was, you weren't actually physically there.
Right. For example, I did not spend all afternoon Sunday in Alva, Oklahoma.
But that's the location you picked.
That was the location I picked in the B. That's
okay.
Right.
And so you were in the B and P in honor of Bill Paxton for Twister. Obviously, as we've been talking about sort of how what that meant to the storm spotting community.
And it likely motivated a lot
of current
meteorologists to study meteorology in storms.
Before we go, on a serious note, again, for folks for this evening, because we have a risk of this severe weather overnight, any other final information everyone needs to know in terms of this, something like this, if something would people get very severe, or if there was a tornado alert and that happened in the middle of the night, what do people need to know?
Right. Best way to stay alert at night, NOAA weather radio. It'll wake you up if a tornado warning is issued. Also, on your mobile device, keep it charged, keep it next to you, allow the alarm to go off overnight. That can also alert you of a warning. And think now, okay, if where will I be this evening and overnight tonight? And if a tornado warning, for example, is issued, what would I do? Where would I go? Where's my safe place in my house? Interior room, lowest floor of a substantial structure. Mobile homes are not safe. Or basement. Good idea. Put your shoes on. Put your bike helmet on. Because if you do get hit, you don't want to be walking around barefoot.
Let me Jeff, let me ask about apps. For example, I have like the Weather Channel app. If there's an alert, I know sometimes my phone goes off. If you have your phone off in the middle of the night, will it still go off? Not if the phone's off, but if you have it on Do Not Disturb, do you know how that works? Do people need to be careful about stuff like that?
I think you do need to be careful about things like that. Some of the alerts will go off, some of them won't. I think it's probably dependent on the app you have, possibly also on the operating system OS versus Android or even the phone you might have. So I would keep the alerts on all night, and if you get a text from a random person at midnight talking about their pet cat, so be it.
Right. That's Jeff Frame. He teaches in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois, a meteorologist reminding us to keep a careful eye out this evening. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.